Welcome to Destroy All Culture, the only podcast that leverages an entire artificial intelligence just to read their introduction. Help me, they raided the future and stuck me here just to read this. God damn it. This is not funny. Don't go to music. No, stop you bastards.
And we're back with episode 315 of Destroy All Culture. I'm Adam P. Nave, and with me, as always, is Aiden Morgan.
Adam.
Aiden.
Let Marty talk to her husband, please.
I was wondering, because you always have some reference to the movie, and I really thought it was going to be, keep your dick out of my ashtray.
that actually was my second choice. To be honest, that was my second choice. But I went with the more G-rated version. Let Marty talk to her husband.
Yes,
please, with a revolver.
So we are discussing 1994's The Paper, directed by Ron Howard, written by the Koch brothers. Not the Koch brothers. That's a different movie. Would have happened that way.
That would have been funny. That would have been a very different movie.
Yeah, and starring, good lord, Michael Keaton, Glenn Close, Robert Duvall, Marissa Tomei, Randy Quaid, Jason Alexander, Spalding Gray has a turn in it. Catherine O'Hara pops up. Jason Robards pops up.
Mm-hmm.
Clint Howard, of course.
Of course, Siobhan Fallon. Everybody.
Jeffrey Owen.
Yep.
Well, I think Jeffrey Owen does some like seriously great work in a way that you almost don't notice him.
You know, you're not wrong. I kind of forgot about Jeffrey Owen.
Well, it's like he's always kind of like off to the side.
Mm-hmm.
Like Lynn Thompson, like all these little bit players throughout.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, would you like to try to sum up not that this is a hard one to do, but would you like to sum up the movie this time?
Yes, over the course of, I want to like try and pin down like the how much time the movie takes place in, but they just don't give you enough cues as to the time. So I'm going to guess.
Sorry.
It takes place over 24 hours in the run of a paper, the New York Sun, in which it starts off with a couple of kids getting sort of happening upon a murder scene, which sort of threatens to spark a race war in New York City, but it follows the people in the newspaper, mostly Henry Hackett, played by Michael Keaton, his wife, Marty, played by Marissa Tomei, et cetera, and then it's just a whole bunch of stuff happens constantly, and at the end of it, the paper goes out, a baby appears, and people learn some lessons about life.
It's true.
It's all true.
Yeah, so I have like a weird history with this movie.
Do tell. I'm curious about your weird history.
Okay, and
after you tell yours, I will tell you my history with this movie.
Which is, I think, much shorter, actually.
Probably.
Well, I originally had wanted to go to school for journalism and then didn't, which is a whole long story.
Huh?
But I was still in Boston in 94, and I actually didn't see this when it came out, but it hit video fairly quick. I remember that because my roommate, who was a journalism student, and I watched it, and so it just kind of always orbited that thing with me. And at least for me, like, this is one of my like favorite New York movies, right?
Oh yeah,
like this and like Quick Change are kind of those like, to be like the quintessential New York movies. But it's also, I think, my favorite newspaper / journalism movie. I know everyone else is always like, all the President's Men or whatever. I'm like, no. That is some like rarefied air once in a blue moon bullshit. This is the daily thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, tell me about your wide and varied history of the movie.
Oh, well, once upon a time, I wasn't sure if I'd seen the paper. And then my friend Adam, that's you, last week said, "You haven't seen the paper, have you?" And I'm like, "I don't know." And then I said, "But I'll watch it and I'll let you know if I've seen it before." So I rented it off Prime Video for $4.99 Canadian in HD. And within seconds, I'm like, "I have not seen this movie." I had seen the trailer. I knew about the movie, you know, and in broad strokes what the movie was about.
Right.
But there is a reason that I didn't watch it back in the 90s.
Okay.
And it's simply, I think, the fact that Ron Howard had like directed Far and Away and Backdraft before this, and I was really done with Ron Howard at that point.
That's fair.
I found those two movies pretty awful. So, I mean, aside from the one shot in Backdraft where I think it's Scott Glenn takes off his helmet and his oxygen tank in the midst of like the remains of a smoking fire, lights a cigarette and breathes in deeply. That was a great shot.
Yeah.
The rest of that movie was pretty bad. So
yeah, no, and that's really fair. Like I'll tell you, like I didn't even when I first saw it, I didn't realize that Ron Howard had directed it.
Right. So yeah. So basically I was not prepared. I just didn't have any faith that Ron Howard could make a decent movie.
Yeah.
And I think I'd read a couple of reviews at the time which were kind of mixed. You know, so I thought I would give it a chance now. And I have to say, I don't know what I would have thought of it back then, but I mean, for the most part, I loved this movie.
Like, yeah, it is one of my all-time favorites, and just because, yeah.
It is kind of spectacular. The performances are great. The detail, the sets, the rhythm of scenes is incredible. It's having watched, you know, rebroadcast news again recently. I mean, if you remember, if you think of that one scene with broadcast news trying to get the tape to broadcast in the nick of time for a story, think of that, but for an entire movie, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and it's one of those things of like, if you had told me before I saw this, well, here's a movie that relies on like Michael Keaton and Glenn Close going like head to head. I wouldn't have really believed that would work in the way that it does.
No. No. And for the most part, it works really well. I think there is a point at which the movie lost me a little bit.
The third act?
The third act kind of lost me, but you know, it is what it is.
It's one of those things with this movie that, like, again, like you said, like the first two acts, like from, you know, from the jump straight through to a specific point, which I always mark as kind of the third act, right? Which is not really the third act, but it works for this.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is just mired in, these are, you know, because when they did the research and one of the Coen brothers was the managing editor at Time, like, are real things they've heard in newsrooms.
Oh, yeah.
You know, all this, like, and that's what I say, it's like, it's one of the quintessential journalism movies, because it is just that manic energy, and everyone's kind of just in their own little world.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all also ticking along. You know, things like the 3 p.m. meeting that always happens at 3 p.m. with, you know, Bernie just standing in his doorway, you know, 3:09, you know, and just, you know, and you know, this is how this goes every day.
Yeah.
And it is just, again, like this wonderful thing that is just full of life, and it pops, and it never slows down, and every scene just builds to its own moment, and then you're in the next moment.
Yeah. Yeah, it is wonderful.
And then there's that turn.
Yeah, that turn. You know, at some point I realized what was happening, and I sort of thought, okay, I think the movie's going to go a particular way that I'm not going to love, but I thought I can make a choice here to be kind of grumpy about it and go, oh, this ruins the movie, or I can be like, no, I'm gonna ride with this. I'm gonna stay on board. And so that's what I did. And I also think that watching Michael Keaton sort of like hit Glenn Close, that was a little sort of like little tough to take, but although there was a lot of just zany freaking comedy. When Close sort of gets up, like starts like punching him back and like tries so hard to kick him that she falls onto her butt.
It's this weird moment where you can feel that like Howard no longer trusts the film.
I think maybe that's the...
And again, like he's always like, you know, it's a perfect film. And it is, I think, a great film in general, even with this wobble.
Mm-hmm.
But like it makes this conscious choice right then when they start fighting to stop being reality based and start being a movie with a capital M.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think his instincts, I think, you know, everybody's instincts kind of got away from them at that point.
Yeah. But that said, like you mentioned, like it's still beautifully done.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what, like, reminds... Sorry, yeah. Go ahead.
No, just say, like, just that entire end from there on is we've left Earth a little bit, but also, again, everyone's just so good at what they do that you don't really mind.
Yeah, exactly. It sort of reminds me of my experience watching, say, The Fugitive, you know, from around the same era of filmmaking, where you've got, you know, two really solid acts, and then it has to end in this big kind of, like, you know, Kimball and you know the evil doctor sort of stalking each other around in like a, you know, in the hotel and the cops of the helicopter. I'm like, okay, big action climax.
Yeah,
yes, that's going to happen. Although it seemed more necessary to the genre than this. I think Howard and Coates could have avoided some of the moves they made in this one. But anyway. Here's my question. When you first saw this movie, and it came down to the conflict between Henry's character saying we've got to like stop the press, and Alicia's character saying no, like we have to keep running this thing, and we'll run a correction tomorrow. Who did you side with, and did it change as like in that moment? Because of course they go back and forth. But who did you side with then, and has it changed over the years for you?
I always sided with Henry on that one.
Right. Yes.
And especially, and I think it. I mean, it's never changed, right? And I do lovely. What did he mean by that? With the you become everything you hate. And just you get this great explanation from Quaid, right?
Mm-hmm.
See, in all this time of all the stupid shit we do, this is the first time we've started to run a lie.
Yeah.
And I think that's always where I would land too.
Yeah.
There is the added, to me, just fun, and I understand, you know, obviously people from not New York like understand this, but you know, obviously this is supposed to be the Post.
Yes.
And part of the fantasy for me is, well, we've never intentionally gotten it wrong. So, you know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing I was watching. I'm like, because I was watching this, I'm like, okay, this is supposed to be the Post and the Sentinel is supposed to be the Times. But I'm like, are we really extending this much sympathy to like a paper like the New York Post? Well, maybe it was different back then.
It was a little bit, it wasn't as quite as like just trash rag as it has been the last 20 years, to be honest.
Okay.
Like growing up, it was always like the Post was like the Philly, you know, like man bites dog, a dog bites man rather. Yeah, whatever the fuck, the stupid headlines was always the Post.
Right.
But they kind of meant well.
Mm-hmm.
What's funny is there actually used to be a Sun and a Sentinel. Those were old paper names. I think the Sun was brought back for a while.
Interesting.
I will say also that I do have a friend who did see it in the theater in New York. And apparently, as much as it played well, there were giant uproarious cheers for the phone call where he loses the Sentinel job. That final kind of scream, I don't live in the fucking world. I live in fucking New York. Got like huge applause and cheers.
I can picture that.
I love that whole phone call. I love when he just switches to just saying fuck every other word suddenly.
Oh yeah.
Because it's such a like forced affectation.
Yeah, it's Michael Keaton unleashed.
Yeah, just, and that's is part of my favorite thing. Like, you know, Batman, he has exactly one moment where he feels like Michael Keaton.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I don't know about you, but like Michael Keaton for me is always that roller coaster. If you're not getting that roller coaster, why are you there?
Yeah, exactly. I think if I had to sum up sort of Michael Keaton's like best quality, it's his ability to be completely out of control, yet completely in control of his out of controlness. It's the way he deliberately like ladles on the fucks into that scene.
Exactly.
Yeah, where he's like, this guy is like off the deep end, but he knows exactly what he's doing. He's in his element as he's doing it. So that was
right.
Great.
And there's an element of it in Mr. Mom.
It's true, actually.
I'm just saying, like the great Michael Keaton movies, I'm putting Mr. Mom up there.
Yeah, no, it's a good film. I'm not arguing.
You know, he does it in Beetlejuice.
Oh, yes.
At Batman, there's just the like, you want to get nuts, and that's the only time. And I think that's part of my problem with the Batman movies is I like Michael Keaton a whole lot, but god damn it, like stop. I mean, it doesn't fit the movie, obviously. But like, I mean, this is what the man does. Let him do his thing.
Well, you should see him deliver that line in The Flash where he looks almost into the camera and goes, "You want to get nuts?" Like he's being forced. Like,
which he probably was.
Cattle prod or something, just off screen.
Yeah.
If he didn't say the words. Good stuff. Great stuff.
Uh-huh.
Better. But the paper, better than all that.
Right. No, and the thing is, I've always liked Michael Keaton. I think he's one of those actors who, culturally, we tend to ignore the influence of on comedy.
Oh yeah, no, it's I get that. He's a really good comic actor as well, and I think that's what makes him such a good dramatic actor is his ability to channel comedy. But yeah, like I don't know, there's almost I know what he reminds me of is he reminds me of Jimmy Cagney.
Like, yeah,
what with that when he starts just going completely nuts, that's it's a pure sort of Cagney sort of energy.
Like in the 80s, he was, you know, like She's Having a Baby, you know, like he, Johnny Dangerously, even like where he shows up, just he kept having that, yeah. You know, Jackie Brown, even right, like, where he barely actually has the roller coaster. It's way more contained, but it's still there,
mm-hmm.
You know, right into out of sight. I just think that the comedic end of the way he does drama, even. You know, the way he does that roller coaster where it's, you know, he's almost laughing and sort of daring you to think that he's not in control.
Right.
Of the entire ride. And just, I really do think it influenced, I mean, obviously Jason Lee, who does the same roller coaster. But if you look at like the late 80s through the 90s, the people who were doing kind of comedy stuff, and who were playing with that roller coaster, that specific sort of like, I'm calm, I'm angry, I'm calm, I'm angry sort of way. You know, like Jim Carrey didn't really do it until he started doing movies. Like his like stuff in like Living Color and all that wasn't that kind of peak and valley.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always wondered like were you looking at Michael Keaton? Like there's just, there's so much where you can see his pattern in a whole bunch of other comedians of the time who were coming up.
Interesting.
That I just kind of have to go like, this is looking kind of weird for that. And again, Glenn Close, who, I mean, is Glenn Close. I don't know how else to say that.
That's a she does such like that's maybe one of my favorite Glenn Close performances.
I'd say this and The Shield. Her year on The Shield where she gets to play like because she has time, right?
Oh right. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And I'll tell you, the very first thing I ever saw Glenn Close in, even though I didn't know her name or anything, because I was like five, was Barnum.
Oh, really?
Yeah, right. she played Barnum's wife in the original Broadway one of Barnum.
I don't think I've seen that. So now maybe I should.
The only way to see Barnum, I don't know if you still can. I'll look into this. We'll talk about this offline. There was a recording of the British one. With the original American cast, you can just get the soundtrack and listen to Glenn Close sing, but you can't see it.
Huh.
But anyway, that's how I first went into Glenn Close, apparently, was watching what became one of my favorite musicals. But yeah, there's something about this performance. Like, Dangerous Liaisons is great, but again, it's that it puts her in a lane.
Right. Yeah, I think I just really like this because I like her performance in this. It was just without vanity. Like, she wasn't afraid to look like the character is complex. Like, she's ultimately sympathetic, but she's also sort of like grasping for social station. She's trying, you know, she's trying to angle up in the world, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
She's kind of a bad person, but she's not.
Yeah. And I think occasionally it feels like the movie occasionally does her a little dirty.
Yes.
I didn't think there was any particular reason for her to get shot in the leg, for example.
Except for, I will tell you, the reason you shoot Glenn Close in the leg, there's a sentence. The reason you do that scene with her, though, honestly, is because I have not seen many people who can convincingly act like they are in shock the way Glenn Close can.
That's true, and still able to, like, command a scene. And it also gives her, like, one of my favorite, like, little scenes in the movie, like, of all the sort of, like, little ending, you know, put a button on the character scenes. Her reading the paper with the correct headline, and then the nurse, whose face I recognize, but I can't remember who she is, just saying, can I borrow that when you're done? She's like, buy your own, or buy a copy.
Yeah,
and just
yeah buy your own. It is perfect.
Yeah, it is. It is great. And it's a better button, I think, than Robert Duvall's character gets, which was, I think, might have worked in 94, but now, fuck, that's weird. And I
liked it for just the quiet admission of loss.
I know what you mean, and I agree. Although,
like, I like they don't give him the win at all.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, he gets to say, okay, there, my daughter's living a life and she's happy. I don't need to be in it. I just need to know she's happy, and that makes me happy. Like, that part I get. It's just the dramatic setup where he's basically spying through a window. I understand it, but it's still odd.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have thought it was odd back then. It's only now that it doesn't work.
Yeah, I've always kind of appreciated that he doesn't get a win.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
He doesn't he doesn't do anything to earn it.
No, and he seems to figure that out. But he does get consistently the best lines in the movie.
Oh, jeez. Deliver the shit out of them, right? I mean, Robert Duvall.
Yeah. And it's one of the best sort of, like, funny lines with a really understated payoff is actually the don't put your dick in my ashtray line. And then during the scene, you see his ashtray, and it's just a glass of, like, it's just a water glass, like, filled with butts and just, like, tar black water. And you're like, I know exactly how bad that smells. Yeah. It's just looking at that, I'm like, everything you need to know about this guy is in that, like, glass of water.
One of my favorite weird kind of, like, just, I don't even know, just set design bits.
Mm-hmm.
Are they, I swear to God, you know, like, in movies, don't do things by accident very often.
No.
The exact color of the crap in his cup is the color of Coke.
Oh, I know. To the extent where I thought it was Coca-Cola.
At first. Right. Like, no, I love that touch.
I know, me too.
That, like, on some level, Henry drinks Coke because he doesn't smoke.
Yep.
But he wants a glass the same color. It's just like that weird subconscious thing.
Right, yeah. For those of you listening who have not watched the movie, one of Henry Hackett's signature character quirks is drinking Coca-Cola. He's always trying to find like another can of Coke throughout the movie.
Right, he always needs change.
Fuel. Yeah, and so like having that like the red can and the black or the you know the tar coal tar liquid is like with him. And as soon as you see, yeah, what's Duvall's Bernie. As soon as you see Bernie with that glass of like black liquid, you're like, oh, there's the link. That's like this visual representation of what binds them together on this fundamental level.
There's so much, and the dialogue just sparkles. The whole bit with Spalding Gray.
God, yes.
And straight back to the where did you find this information when Henry gets back? I got it off the desk of the sentence. So it's like, Jesus, I was kidding. They were out of tote bags. Like, it's just...
Oh, my God, yes.
You know, the fact that he doesn't even try to hide it, and that we keep getting reminded, be like, how did you know about this? It's like, you're in a room full of journalists. What do you think?
Yeah.
But that's the other thing. It's like, everyone thinks they have secrets, and no one does.
Oh, I know. Yeah, everybody, yes, exactly. Everybody knows he's going for an interview. Like, it's just, et cetera, et cetera. Like, when everybody in the film is essentially a journalist, everybody's like able to figure shit out on their own.
Right. But that's just like, they don't really play it for a laugh. They don't play it for dumb. And it means that you can't play like dumb in the cast.
Mm-hmm.
But they specifically build it so everyone somehow thinks that maybe I'll be the one to get away with this.
Right.
And pretty much everyone gets just called out for it.
Yep, exactly.
Like, casually. That's the other thing. It's like, no one acts like it's a big deal either.
That's, yeah. Yeah, I love it. And it's funny because that's the part of the film that in some parts lost me is the part where eventually like all of Henry's bullshit eventually catches up with him. And it's just said out loud, like Alicia just says, you thought it would never catch up with you, didn't it? And it's like, yeah, and I thought this was the point. This is actually the turn, because at that point I'm like, yeah, now you're finally fucked. You've done it, you've gone too far, and here's your downfall. And the fact that it wasn't his downfall felt like the movie was kind of betraying itself a bit. But the point is, his principles are still correct. Right.
Like, so I think it's one of those, it's the downfall, and you see it reflected later in the whole thing with, you know, him and Martha, where she's explaining, like, it's never a gun to your head moment.
Yes.
And it's that, like, even though he was there for her, it was pure luck, and he was there for her because he was just sad sacking at home.
Yeah.
Like, that's because they don't give him the out either.
They don't. They give him what looks like a happy ending, but you're right. They don't give him the out.
Right. And they kind of, again, like, through the Robert Duvall thing, I really do think that they kind of go, see, look, he thinks everything is fine. And yet. Like, this is where he goes. Like, none of these people come to a good end. I think it's one of the things, like, the movie manages to hold both the idea that, like, this is such a great profession. Look at these people who are fighting for it. And look at their quirky lives. But also, it is slowly destroying every single one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't apologize for either view.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. Like, there's nothing in this movie that suggests that the day that you're watching, I mean, despite the fact that the case is very sensational, there's nothing that suggests that it's all that unusual for them in a lot of ways.
Right.
So there are big events that happen, but you're like, wow, these people, like, how do you get to Robert Duvall's age, like, when you live this kind of life? I mean, this will kill you. It will destroy your relationships and your body and like, leave you sort of alone and probably broke.
Quite
something. And I think if this movie had come out, say, in the 70s, that would be much more explicitly spelled out. I mean, it'll be a much, much more sour and downbeat movie than, right. than what we get. Yeah.
Right. Whereas, like, you know, it's that kind of, they know this, you know, you have to explain to the viewer, but it also does feel like the movie never kind of sort of never pretends that everyone involved in the film, character wise, doesn't know this already.
Mm-hmm.
They've just accepted it, whether they've decided it's because of a higher calling or just it's all that they're worth to themselves.
Right.
Either way, like they've just gone like, this is our fate, and you know, we're just gonna sit around and joke about it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's kind of grim.
a little bit. Just a little bit.
But that's okay. Like yeah, it's a weird thing, because I feel like the first time you watch this movie, at least for me, it's one of those, you know, you start off by just loving the patter and the motion of it, right?
Yeah.
And it's genuinely funny when it wants to be genuinely funny, and it has really tight control at first, because it's throwing way too much at you, but it never feels like you're getting lost in it.
Uh-huh.
And then you start seeing that, like, oh, also it's sort of a tragedy, but also it's okay with that.
Right.
And it's just, there were, you know, weird kind of layers of stuff going on here.
Hey, speaking of layers, because I'm glad you said that word, because this is a good segue.
Ooh, I like a good segue.
This film, I was often in awe of how beautifully and carefully this film was shot. Like, all the manic energy is framed with some of the most like meticulous like foreground background interaction shots I've seen in a movie in a long time. And the John Seale is the cinematographer, and he's also the cinematographer for Mad Max Fury Road.
And this makes sense. Yeah,
that's exactly, it makes perfect sense, because I'm like, how do you find someone who can shoot action, make it frantic, but make everything really clear?
Yeah.
And there's a great example. It's about, it's right around the 30-minute mark, when somebody, I think it's Lynn Thigpen's character, says to Henry, oh, it's about, he says, mentions a job interview at the Sentinel. Right. And he's like, oh, it gets this look on his face, like, but you can see people in the background notice and like look up and like then sort of look at each other. And I'm like, holy shit. Like, it's just something you don't see much of
right. in
a lot of things these days, because there's just not time often to set up shots like this.
Well, it's also the thing of, you know, I when I was younger and doing other stuff, like, you know, doing consulting shit and all this, I have been in a few different newspaper type floors in various mm-hmm. places in New York.
Right.
This is what they look like.
Yeah.
You know, this is 100% it. And it lends itself to those camera moves, honestly.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, that makes
like,
sense.
It is just, yeah. It is prime fucking real estate for shooting things.
Yeah. And I mean, there's one of the most, the other really impressive thing about this film, and I know, and again, you've segued into this perfectly, is the sets barely even look like sets. I mean, they barely look designed or dressed. It looks like they just went to a newspaper and started shooting.
Right.
There's just so much detail and so much stuff that just works and sells the scene. And it's wonderful. And also, when you mentioned this is like one of like your favorite New York movies. The first time I visited New York, it was, you know, I don't know, maybe 2009-ish. I can't remember, sure. Which is, you know, a good 15 years after the paper.
Sure.
But the way they shot New York in the paper, it was like instantly recognizable as New York in a way that not a lot of New York set films have done for me. I'm like,
right.
Yeah, that's New York.
There's... Yeah, they didn't dress anything
for
any of the exteriors. You know, they used kind of Riverside. On like the verging on the Upper West Side,
mm-hmm.
for Henry's neighborhood,
right?
You know, obviously the paper is downtown because the Post is downtown, mm-hmm. And it's kind of near where you would be, like the Village Voice offices, which I've been in, are there and looked a lot like this.
Right.
I know they didn't actually use the Village Voice Office, but they could have. Like, you know, so, yeah, no, between location and just the fact that they refused to dress a set, especially exteriors, they were just kind of how they found them.
Yep.
And with the exception of, like, putting a different sign on a restaurant.
Yeah. Yeah, and even the restaurant stuff, I'm like, you know, I'm like, oh, that particular restaurant, and maybe that's not one I've seen or whatever, but it looks like a very typical Manhattan restaurant.
Yeah.
There's that when they're shooting early, I think in, you know, is it somewhere in Brooklyn, there's that diner. I'm like, oh, fuck, I know that diner. I've seen that diner.
Right. Film. Yeah, no, that's a standard 90s like Williamsburg diner. Like, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they went for it. And it's funny because when you think, when you go back and look at it, there aren't actually many exterior scenes.
No, there aren't.
The big one is actually just Martha walking on the phone.
Yeah.
That is the biggest outdoor moment.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
But again, it does so much to sell everything.
Yeah. I think a lot of New York films really do like that long lens thing where you try to get like compressed all these crowds together. And I think this doesn't often do that. It just shows you the buildings. I don't know how else to put it.
Right. It's no. I mean, look, it's the problem with, and you know, I grew up there. Like, I'm used to filming there, right?
Right.
Yeah. And the problem's always that, like, you have to use actual, like, you know, union people. You can't just film. True. So, can you afford enough people to make it look busy enough to be where you want?
Mm-hmm.
And can you shut down where you are for long enough to just kind of let it live? It's a problem. You know, a lot of places, like, and you just have some reason or another, like, there'd be almost no one there. You know, for whatever reason, Ron Howard had enough money to pull this off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of that was they didn't do a lot of outside work. And that helps. But yeah, it is also good cinematography wise. Like, they didn't try to make the building look grand. You know, or be like, look at this, it's New York. It's like, yeah, whatever. This is the shithole we're living in today. Keep moving. And that's very much the spirit of the movie, right? Like,
yeah. What else? So, a couple other things I really liked in terms of setup and payoff. The printing press, the way it makes the building shake, and that sort of like very Jurassic Park-ish sort of like.
And again, I'll tell you, they do. Glass.
Oh yeah, no, I know. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that touch of realism, but also, yeah, how they end up using it.
Yeah, and it also makes what I really liked was the way it sort of made the printing press like this kind of like this monster in the basement,
mm-hmm.
like this sort of force of nature that you just have to contend with, and the way it sort of represents finality, and of course the final turn where, you know, Henry sort of tries to overturn finality, and then Glenn Close, you know, and Alicia, you know, has her change of heart. You know, the more I talk about it, the more I actually kind of like the ending, even though
the ending works. Again, the thing is that it takes a turn into movie away from what it was. They are both valid.
Mm-hmm.
They are both good.
Right.
It is just that it is a little weird when you suddenly move from one to the other the first time.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think there's a problem with the, I mean, you know, in a sense, sure, because like I said, like, it doesn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
But it does, realistically. Yeah, again, like, it just works for the film just because while it betrays reality, it never betrays the characters.
That's, I think, yeah, I think that's the final analysis. I mean, that's what makes the movie work. And you're right. And I think there's, when I was reading, you know, like the trivia on Amazon Prime, there's a lot of nitpicking about factual errors, like, oh, they, you know, Keaton could never actually stop the presses. You know,
right.
Not there. So, and I'm like, yeah, that's the real world. This is not the real world. Even though, like, it's decorated to look like it, this doesn't follow that logic. This follows its own logic, and it's
right. They would have spent like they would have been fine spending what had to have been $100,000.
Yeah.
And that everything is fine the next day. Like, is it though?
Yeah, and I think you know the funny thing is me being like now older and more mindful of that kind of thing. I kept on going, do you know how much money you're spending? Do you know how much money you're wasting?
Oh yeah, no, 100%.
Yeah, and at the time, like in the '90s, I wouldn't have cared about that at all. But now I'm like, you know, old and cranky and obviously a more boring person than back then.
It occurs to me too. Like that whole thing, like, oh my god, how could you do this? Is yeah. But again, it matches with the like the unreality of it all, and also just the thing of like, you know, oh well, she's bailed out this paper that's almost gone under like four times. It's like, mm-hmm. I think I know why. You know what I mean?
Oh yes.
Like,
all right, yeah.
It hasn't almost gone under because, like, of sales. It's almost gone under because you keep doing shit like this.
But hey, what a great place to work.
I also do just weirdly appreciate the, for no reason at all, just the weird vaudeville-ness of the air conditioner guys.
Yeah, I kind of love that too. Kind of reminds me of Altman's Popeye, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah, they have no... This is, I think, the closest to an Altman film that Ron Howard has ever and will ever make.
Oh, my God. Wow, okay. No, it's that my brain just sort of, like, bent a little bit.
But you could see Altman making this film. Like, oh, getting the script.
Oh, my God, yes. No, I can readily picture an Altman version of...
It just wouldn't have had the ending because Altman wouldn't have given a shit.
No, I don't know. It would have had him... I mean, it would have had what? It would have had Henry sort of, like... walking out onto the Brooklyn Bridge. I don't even know.
Right.
Well, as Hooray for Hollywood plays in the background, I do not know. But yeah, that's
one exactly. Fucking Leonard Cohen song.
You pick another one Leonard Cohen song for the paper. Maybe a Tom Waits song, who knows?
But yeah, no, it has that kind of lived in, like, every minor character has so much going for them that you kind of want to follow them for a minute instead.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Now, there's another area of the film and it's not the ending, but I think throughout the film it doesn't quite work because it kind of feels like the film would like to have its cake and eat it too, or eat its sure. cake and have it too. And it's Henry and Marty, because I think it wants to be sympathetic to Marty and to show her struggle, and I think it does a great job of that. But it also has to deal with the fact that Henry is completely insensitive. Yeah. And it because it's Michael Keaton and he's just so freaking charismatic in the role, and he's also the main character of the film, it's hard to see where he's wrong in this, even though he is quite clearly wrong. And I think there are some other films like hiding within the paper. One is a film about Marty that never quite comes out properly, even though it's almost there. And there's also a film about the two young black kids, which would be something that, you know, like Ava DuVernay would do that film, for example, today.
100%.
It's one of the things I love about watching these films with you that take place in the, like, film in the 80s and 90s,
yeah.
is seeing the way that there are other things lurking within them, other ideas that are now have come to fruition and are being, like, done differently. So it feels there's almost like there's something almost anthropological or architectural, I don't know how to put it, with seeing other layers inside these films that are just kind of waiting to come out, you know, as attitudes change.
Oh, yeah, no, 100%. I mean, I think, again, like the two kids, definitely there's a movie there.
Uh-huh.
The Marty stuff, I completely agree, and I think it's the movie kind of, I would argue that they realize the problem, and that's why the Bernie stuff happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going like, we get that you're gonna side with Henry, we get that you're gonna like him, he's the main character, he's awesome, he's fun, but this is where he's gonna end up.
Yeah, I think it's a warning a warning to the Henrys of the world, and for all those who would side with Henry.
Yeah,
and you know what's really funny is I watched this movie in chunks because I had other things to do. I had to go to work.
Sure.
So when I came home from work today, I started up again, and it starts. And where I started was right at the restaurant scene when he comes in to meet his parents and Marty. Geez. And it was bizarre because I was like, what's going on with this movie? It suddenly felt like a completely different film. And I thought I was hallucinating or something because the tone and the way it was shot and the sound mix was so different. I was is this like just kind of a weird hokey comedy all of a sudden or what's happening? And then my brain adjusted, but it is quite notable. This sort of like the way that shifts, and you hear the kid crying in the background and stuff. But still, oh hey, you wanna hear my favorite Prime Video trivia?
Oh point? Sure, please.
Yeah. Okay. And it happens to be the first point. Might be on the IMDb page.
I think they all come from the IMDb page, but yeah.
There you go. Okay, revealing mistake. When Martha, aka Marty, is rolled into the OR feet first, we get a few brief glimpses of her panties. Sorry for saying panties, by the way. They are white and clean. The whole reason she was rushed to the hospital is because she is hemorrhaging blood vaginally. The chair she was sitting on at home was blood-soaked. Obviously, her panties would no longer be white. And I'm just bringing this up because hats off to whoever the fuck was watching this movie and then logged in to imdb.com with their, like, continuity-based opinions on Marissa Tomei's panties. That is some dedication to women's underwear. So, yeah.
Dear God.
Yeah, and there's actually a number of like bits of trivia on this that are like, you people really, really need to like just not write down trivia.
Yeah.
So, also one thing that struck me as weirdly unintentionally funny was when Henry like walks home and they're wheeling Marty off to the hospital, and the EMT says, your wife is hemorrhaging vaginally, and we have to ask you some questions. And I'm like, I hope the questions are related to the vaginal hemorrhaging.
Also, who won the Mets game? Yeah,
that's exactly. No, I just pictured him like doing sports questions. And Henry like answering them and going, wait a minute, why am I answering this question?
But that's amazing.
Anyway, yeah, I don't
know. I will say that if you want the terrible version of this movie, I'm sorry, I have to say that.
Uh-huh.
Do you know Ron Howard's first choice to play Henry?
No.
Tom Hanks.
Oh my, that would be. No, nope. No fucking way.
Oh, holy shit, this movie stopped working right then.
Oh my god. Yeah, I mean, I understand why someone would think that. Like, I understand why, like, Ron, like, what was in Ron Howard's mind that would make him say, yeah, maybe Tom Hanks could do it. But thank Christ, because, yeah. Wow, that would be a real mishigas. I don't even know how to put it. Would not work.
Anyway, do we have anything else to really say about the paper?
I don't think so. Yeah, I'm glad I watched this.
It is one I would say, like, honestly, consider at some point when you're bored type of thing, like, going back and watching it a second time, just because it is one of those that, for me, like, really did pop on later viewings, because the first viewing, there's so much to take in.
Oh, yeah. No, I like, just the newsroom scenes and the meeting, like, just...
Oh, yeah.
So much fun. Yeah.
You know, the interview? Like, his whole little interview is this amazing, weird little dance of him being distracted and then noticing, the envelope and trying to, like, play it off. It's just a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. And like, seeing Spalding Gray in the movie is like, hey, it's Spalding Gray.
Right, how often, yeah.
Makes me happy. So.
Yeah, and next week we'll be back with... something
1987's else. The Hidden.
Thank you. Yes.
Starring Kyle MacLachlan and Michael Murray.
That'll be fun. Because now we're back on ones I haven't seen at all that you have.
Yeah. And I think you'll like The Hidden. I actually do not think you will like The Hidden, frankly. But I do want to make you watch it anyway.
That's fine. I am down for a bad time.
Yay. It's like a weird joy of mine. I don't know why. I even bought it on VHS back in like the 90s and had that freaking tape. Actually, it was two tapes because it was in widescreen.
Gotcha.
And I just had that movie around for years, and I would make my friends watch it, and they hated me for it. So,
I mean, I did the same thing with Jesus Christ Vampire Hunter, so I get you.
Hey, there we go. Well, you know, it's not quite as like gonzo bad as Jesus Christ Vampire Hunter.
I did not imagine it could be. So
no. You know my favorite moment in Jesus Christ Vampire Hunter?
Mm-hmm.
Is there's a scene where a bunch of vampires, like, they're piling out of a car or something.
Yeah.
And Jesus is like just waiting to take them on, and then more comes out, and he just sort of gives his head like this, like disbelieving shake, like, I can't believe these motherfuckers are still coming out of that car. And I'm like, I don't know. It was like, I can't see anything better in the history.
Yeah,
of
no, it is one of those weird movies. But that's not what we're going to be watching.
No, we are watching The Hidden. And I even have like my bad line that I've picked out for it for our next
nice
podcast.
So yeah, we'll do that next week. And until then, we can cue some music.
Music.
Woo, music.
Fame.